God's Camp. Coming back from the HMC retreat at Silver Lake last year, Jeremy stood right here and told us, come on, rearrange your lives, get your priorities straight, make more room in your lives for Silver Lake. So clearly I was paying attention, and I made the changes in my own life, and now here I am working at Silver Lake. How many of us here would identify as campers? Anyone? So this morning, I am going to suggest to you that all of us are campers at God's Camp. My intention isn't to present a message of exclusion. I felt so bad in the children's time with a child who isn't coming to camp, but that's not my intention. Silver Lake is not the only place that a child or an adult can go to find the breadth and depth of God's love. At the same time, Silver Lake is our camp, and so I want to freely share with you its beauty. Many of you have rich stories of connection to Silver Lake, longer and deeper than mine, from being a camper to work weekends to retreats, prayers, financial support, vision for the future. HMC has had a profound part and continues to have a profound part in Silver Lake's journey. I asked current HMC Silver Lake campers for a word to explain what they loved about camp, and you heard some of that in the children's time already. Here is the full list of what they said. Everything! Gagaball, cabins, it's awesome. Prank night and planning prank night. I'm told that last year some leaders bit into some salt-filled cookies, and there's some connection to salt of the earth in that somewhere. Archery, fun, trampoline that you heard about, swimming, water, that it's welcoming, being away from everyday busy life, and being with nature. So Dave Erb told me that often when he would speak at churches, he wouldn't mention some of the practical information about camp that you may be interested in. So I'm just going to shove some of that at you before we get going here, and then you can tell me if you have any other questions that you want to have answered. So we have 704 registrations already, which is the most that Silver Lake has ever had at this point in the year. Full is 782, so we're well on our way. Our outdoor education program is thriving. May and June now is completely booked. We're actually starting to turn people away, which is sad for us, but it's also very great. So that's new, and that's exciting that it's continuing to grow in that way. There's a new climbing tower up at camp, and hopefully some of you will have a chance to use it at some point, maybe at the Silver Lake Retreat, we'll see. And we're $465,000 on our way to accomplishing our $800,000 campaign. So we're still looking for support with that. And drawings for the new retreat center space, which we're hoping to start building a year from now, will be unveiled at the Paddle the Grand AGM event in the middle of May. Is there anything else like that you want to know about Silver Lake that you're just dying to get an answer to? What was that? I think I missed someone's comment there, sorry. If not, okay, well then, let's get going. A few weeks ago, I had a phone call from someone considering sending their child to Silver Lake. She hadn't been to Silver Lake, and neither had her kids. It's hard to trust your child to a community that you don't know and that your child has never been to, so she had questions. She wanted to know, what's it like being in a cabin? When do kids get up? How do they get changed? I had, no idea whatsoever. I have heard that sometimes when pastors apply for positions, if there's a spouse involved, that sometimes the spouse gets roped in to do additional work, and I do not advocate that practice. In this situation, I may or may not have roped my children into responding. So what did I do? I put the woman on speakerphone, and Kara and Henry were there, and right away they had answers to her questions, and I could feel the woman's anxiety just drop down because she trusted the answers that Kara and Henry were giving her because they came out of an open-hearted love for Silver Lake. Trust. I happened to be studying in Rochester a few months after 9/11, and plastered everywhere were "In God We Trust" signs like this. What does that speak to you? Tell me, how do you respond to that message? What do you see in that? The flag? You see a flag? Pardon me? I'm sorry, people are saying things quietly. I can't hear. The flag, yeah. Claire? A bag, yeah. It's a shopping bag, isn't it? Absolutely. What does this message speak to us? What does it say? Oh, Henry. In God USA we trust. That's it. I find it fascinating that we can say that we trust in something and actually be trusting in something else. In this case, the trust was in shopping. Let's bring back some stability and get the economy going, and that will see us through the grief and the insecurity that we feel because of the violence that was done to us. Who or what, if anything, do we trust? And how do we trust? Ann Naylor in the Huffington Post writes this. She says, you may have heard the Sufi story. There was once a man who was on his way back home from market with his camel. And as he just had a good day, he decided to stop at a mosque along the road and offer his thanks to God. He left his camel outside and went in with his prayer mat and spent several hours offering thanks to Allah, praying and promising he'd be a good Muslim in the future, help the poor, and be an upstanding pillar in his community. When he emerged, it was already dark. And lo and behold, his camel was gone. He immediately flew into a temper, shook his fist at the sky, yelling, "You traitor, Allah! How could you do this to me? I put all my trust in you, and you go and you stab me in the back like this." A passing Sufi dervish heard the man yelling and chuckled to himself. "Listen," he said, "trust God, but, you know, tie up your camel." Anne says that trust is a cooperative venture between your inner knowing or spirit and the world in which you live. It's active, aware, and alert. Not blind and unknowing. The theme of trust, particularly trusting God, is woven throughout Scripture. In the Old Testament, we hear about Abraham, who's called to a nomadic life to grow his trust in God. Same is true of the Israelites wandering around in the desert. Jacob spent his life struggling with trust. He wrestled with his brother, Esau. He wrestled with his mom. He wrestled with his dad. He wrestled with his uncle, Laban. He wrestled with his wives. We pick up the story that Karen so beautifully read for us when he's about to experience the deepest struggle of his life. 20 years prior to that, Jacob left the country, fleeing his past and a brother who wanted to kill him. At that time, he saw a ladder connecting heaven and earth and the angels of God ascending and descending on it. After that, he fled from Laban, his uncle, who was trying to control his future. Now, when he's in danger, when he's vulnerable and needs them, Jacob sees God's angels again. Ross and Julie Cochran write that Jacob has been no angel, and yet when he needs them, angels come. They camp with him. It's on his way home, following the path to God's heart, that Jacob meets angels and says, "This is God's camp." And he calls it, Karen pronounced it better than I will, I'll say Mannheim, which means double camp, probably referring to either the family camp and the angel camp, or two camps of angels, one before and behind, as a symbol of complete protection. Whatever the meaning, it's at God's camp that Jacob's moment of transformation occurs. God has called him to be present and to go home, which means facing his brother and his past. Maybe some of us can relate to what God is asking of Jacob. Maybe God is asking us or has asked us to confront our past or our future. And in those moments, we need all the help we can get. Every year, a friend of ours chooses a word for the year that she tries to live into, and I decided I would do that too. I chose the word open. My tendency when I feel insecure, trapped, or attacked is to shut down. But God calls us to a different path, the path of open trust, which obviously is a huge concept that needs to be nuanced with healthy boundaries and soul searching and good support, all of those things. But trust is connected to openness and openness to vulnerability. Brené Brown talks about the gift of vulnerability, of daring greatly, and she unearths the way that in our culture, shame can prevent us from really connecting with ourselves, with others, and with God. This is something that Jacob could relate to. Betty Priest writes, "Before Jacob wrestles with a stranger, Jacob wrestles with himself. In fact, one has the impression that Jacob has been wrestling with himself, his jealousy, and his shame for most of his life. He vies for a blessing, feels like he's never enough, he's jealous of his older brother, and he practices deceit to cover up his feelings of inadequacy. How often is that our practice too? Covering up vulnerability with unhealthy tools to avoid it. We can justify all kinds of unhealthy behavior when we're scared, when we feel small, or when we feel insecure in some way. It is through the struggle at God's camp that Jacob sheds a layer of skin that was never really helping him to begin with. Perhaps our temptation is not to struggle directly like Jacob did, but rather to sidestep the struggle or to give up or to struggle with distractions rather than getting to the heart of what needs to be struggled with. But here, Jacob finally is direct. Even after his hip is dislocated, he holds on and openly asks for a blessing. No deception, no trying to be somebody else, just him asking. Yesterday at the MCEC meetings, Bruxy Cavey spoke to this outstandingly, the idea of holding on and letting go. It was amazing, and challenging us to know when do we do which. And even as Jacob held on, he had to let go of a whole bunch of other things, whole other unhealthy patterns of being. Instead of giving a blessing when he's asked, the stranger asks Jacob his name. What is the meaning of his name? It means deceiver. Jacob had to admit that he was the deceiver. Years ago, when his father had asked him who he was, he lied, and he said his name was Esau to get what he wanted, the blessing. But now he admits that he is Jacob, and he receives the blessing that God had always intended for him to have. Betty Priest writes that Jacob confesses that he's been jealous, ashamed of his identity as a younger brother. He confesses that he's made his life by way of deceit, that he has covered his shame by tricking others to get ahead. In this pivotal moment, Jacob's confession is simultaneously a request for healing. And once the confession is made, Jacob is offered a new name, Israel, one who struggles with God and prevails. Jacob is released from his deceit and given a new way of being. Jacob is transformed. The verse finally tells us who has been wrestling with Jacob. It's God. It's a surprise. In our lives too, God is a surprise and can take on surprising forms. In holding on, we actually let go and find ourselves in a surprising place. Wrestling with God changed Jacob forever. It also wounded him. It was painful. Nobody walks away from that kind of struggle without a limp to become a wounded healer. Are we prepared to be at God's camp in that way? Have you been struggling with God? Are you being asked to struggle with God now? If you are, hold on to God until the blessing comes. It will come, even if there is pain along the way. At God's camp, whether on the way to Palestine like Jacob or Silver Lake or wherever God invites us to struggle, to confess, and to be transformed, we will find our way. Through his struggle, Jacob finds what is true, that God loves him. He is beloved, and that is enough. We will find that too. We grow in trust when we grow in knowing that we are loved, which brings us to our New Testament passage, John 1, 14 and 16. John's gospel is known as the gospel of love, and the passage today reads that, "And the word became flesh," can be translated, "and camped among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as of a father's only son, full of grace and truth. And from his fullness, we have all received grace upon grace upon grace." Dr. Dan Hayden writes that when God came to earth, in a spiritual sense, God went camping. The word used in John 1:14 means to pitch a tent, and the same word is used for the tabernacle of God. The writer of Hebrews calls God's glory the true tent that the Lord set up. The glory of God went camping with Israel as Israel wandered in the wilderness. Years later, when the temple of God was about to be destroyed, Ezekiel described how the glory of God left the earth and went back to heaven. And 600 years later, John wrote the glory of God had come back, this time in a new tent, the body of Jesus Christ. By introducing Christ in this way, John is saying, he's back. God is pitching his tent among us once again. Jesus Christ, who is the Word, camped among us, and John describes the birth of Jesus as the pitching of the tent. And Jesus came to camp with us so that we can be with God. The God who calls us to hold all things with open hands, vulnerably, ready to move, to bless others, chose the life of a camper and all that comes with it. Why camp here? Because God loves us and wants to be with us. One of the great gifts of the Christian story is this notion of God camping with us, the incarnation. We describe it as an act of love that God relates with us, connects with us, communes with us. And in the words of Joan Osborne, which are somewhat dated but still interesting, what if God is one of us? Silver Lake is not the perfect community, but it is a beloved community. And out of that love, it is a community that pours out love. When you experience that, it's unmistakable. I find myself already being transformed through it. Martin Luther King writes about the beloved community. He says, "But the end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. This type of goodwill that will transform the deep gloom of the old age into the exuberant joy of the new age. It is love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of all." And Henry Nouwen continues this thought, saying, "This groaning comes from deep within us, indeed from within all creation. It's the sound of our yearning for communion with God and with one another." So what is the meaning of communion? At its very basic, it's a common union. It has been, it is, and it will be the center of our Christian faith. It comes from the root of sharing, participation by all, and is used in words like common, community, and communicate. It's meant to bring us together. Dean McLennan writes that communion is not just a matter of ingathering, it nourishes us into an outpouring of love. Jesus always did both. He gathered people to break bread together and then sent them out to feed and clothe people around them, to comfort others. True sharing of the bread is sharing an outpouring of love for others and love for oneself. Two articles that really made an impact on me last fall as I began my journey as Silver Lake's executive director. The first one is from National Geographic. Some of you may have read the October issue where it says, "Can the selfie generation unplug and get into parks?" Jonathan Jarvis, the director of National Parks, said that youth are more separated from the natural world than perhaps any generation before them. 71% of millennials say they would be very uncomfortable on a week vacation without connectivity. Young people devote more than 7 hours a day, that's more than 50 hours a week, in front of a screen. And for many of us, that would also be true with our work and all of the impact that screen has on us. For children 11 to 14 years old, it's 12 hours a day in front of a screen. The article goes on to quote Richard Louv from his book, Last Child in the Woods, who believes that a big problem with children is nature deficit disorder and argues that certain behavioral problems may be a consequence of how little time our children are spending outdoors. He says that kids who are not divorced from nature are less likely to get sick, be stressed, and are more adaptable. In the second article from Maclean's last September, there's a story, the title of which was Bella Bella, the Town That Solved Suicide. And the subtitle is How Remote Bella Bella Emerged from Its Dark Time, Reconnecting Troubled Youth with the Land. The dark time references a time when Bella Bella was experiencing one suicide a month. I can't even imagine what that must have been like for them. Jurgensen, a social worker, seeing how detached Halsuk kids had become from the land, began taking them out into the watershed, building cabins with them, teaching them about the vast territory which stretches over 17,000 square kilometers. Koye Camp, a summer camp for the youth in a river valley about an hour south of Bella Bella, was formed with the idea of taking kids out of their comfort zone and going into the wild so that they could better understand who they were and where they came from. Over time, these campers became counselors, and then they began emerging as cultural and community leaders. The graduation rate in Bella Bella now tops 85%, up from 2% in the 70s. There are still youth at risk in that community, but it's been over 15 years since they've had a suicide. In both these articles, National Geographic and Maclean's, I hear a deep yearning for communion and the struggle, the deep, profound spiritual wrestling that is happening as a culture as we look for that communion. Last summer, I was up at camp for a few days, and I walked through the woods, and I unexpectedly came to a labyrinth. You can flip to the next slide, too. So for those of you who want to, I don't know if you can quite see it, but it's this path that kind of goes through the trees to the heart of God. The moment I saw it, it was such a surprise to me, an example of God surprising us in our lives, and I knew I was home. Labyrinths are a form of pilgrimage. They're used as a metaphor for pilgrimage, which is itself a metaphor for life, which we are all on. On Monday, I had the privilege of meeting up with the pilgrims on their way to Ottawa with the Pilgrimage for Indigenous Rights. Something about seeing those pilgrims, every time I see pilgrims, it just brings tears to my eyes. The trust that they have walking down the highway, the vulnerability of that experience, the love that they show with each step that they take, and the knowledge that they are loved and upheld in prayer. We can flip there. The journey of the labyrinth is the journey to the heart of God. And as we journey towards that love, paradoxically, like the Pilgrims for Indigenous Rights, we journey outward into true sharing with others. That is the journey we are all on, whether we're at Silver Lake, here at HMC, or wherever we are. Silver Lake is a community that seeks trust and love on the path of God's heart, communion. May we all find our way to God's camp, knowing God is with us, becoming more of who we are through whatever struggle and whatever blessing we face along the way. Thanks be to God.